Jace. We knew we wouldn't be able to be in touch with them while they were gone. Simon, he's Clary's parabatai. He would feel it if anything had happened to her, and Alec would as well about Jace. Emma couldn't argue the strength of the parabatai bond. She glanced down, wondering. They've come. It was Magnus, reaching to take Max from Isabel. He gave Emma an odd, sideways look that she couldn't read. The brothers. Emma glanced over. It was true. They had glided almost soundlessly into the crowd, parting it like the Red Sea. Shadow hunters fell back as the beers carrying Livy and Robert passed among them and stopped between the pyres. Livy lay pale and bloodless, her body swathed in a white silk dress, white silk binding her eyes. Her gold necklace glittered at her throat. Her long brown hair was scattered with white flowers. Livy dancing on her bed, wearing a pale green chiffon dress she'd bought at Hidden Treasures.
Emma! Emma! Look at my new dress!
Emma struggled against the memory, against the cold truth. This was the last dress she would see Livy wear. This was the last time she would see her familiar brown hair, the curve of her cheek, her stubborn chin. Livy. My Livy. My wise little owl. My sweet little sister. She wanted to scream. But shadow hunters didn't cry out at death. They spoke the old words instead, handed down through the ages. Awe atque wale, the murmur went through the crowd. Awe atque wale, Robert Lightwood. Awe atque wale, Livia Blackthorne. Isabel and Alec turned to face their father's bier. Julian and the other Blackthorns were still pinned in by well-wishers. For a moment, Emma was alone with Simon. I talked to Clary before she left, she said, the words feeling like a hot pressure in the back of her throat. She was worried something bad was going to happen. Simon looked puzzled. What kind of bad thing? Emma shook her head. Just if she doesn't come back when she's supposed to. Simon looked at her with troubled eyes, but before he could say anything, Gia stepped forward and began to speak.
Shadow hunters die young, said someone in the crowd.
Julian didn't recognize the man. He was probably in his early 40s with thick black eyebrows. He wore a patch on his gear, with the symbol of the Skolomance on it, but little else differentiated him from the dozens of other people who had come up to Julian to tell him they were sorry his sister was dead.
But 15.
The man shook his head. Gladstone, Julian recalled. His last name was Gladstone.
Robert lived a full life. He was a distant cousin of mine, you know. But what happened to your sister should never have happened. She was only a child.
Mark made a strangled noise behind Julian. Julian said something polite to send Gladstone on his way. Everything felt distant, muffled, as if he or the world had been wrapped in cotton padding.
I didn't like him, said Drew, after Gladstone had gone.
The skin under her eyes was shiny and tight where tears had left traces that couldn't be washed away. It was as if there were two Julians. One was Julian before, the Julian who would have reached over to comfort Drew, ruffled her hair. Julian now didn't. He remained motionless as the crowd started to surge apart to make way for the funeral procession and saw Helen lift Tavi up into her arms.
He's 7, he said to her. He's too old to be carried everywhere.
She gave him a half-surprised, half-reproachful look, but said nothing. The Silent Brothers were walking between them with their beers, and the Blackthorn family stilled as the air filled with a chant of the Nephilim. Awe atque wale, Livia Blackthorn. Hail and farewell.
Drew jammed the heels of her hands into her eyes. Aline put an arm around her. Julian looked for Ty. He couldn't stop himself. Mark had gone over to Ty and was talking to him. Kit stood beside him, hands shoved in his pockets, shoulders hunched, altogether wretched. Ty himself was staring at Livy's beer, a spot of red burning on each of his cheeks. On the way down from the city, he had peppered Julian with questions. Who touched her in the Silent City? Did they wash the blood off her? Did they brush her hair? Did they take her necklace? Did they let you have her clothes? Who picked a dress for her to be buried in? Did they close her eyes before they tied the silk over them? Until Julian had been exhausted and near snapping. Ladders had been placed beside the pyres, each one a massive stack of logs and kindling. A silent brother took Livy's body and began to climb the ladder. When he had reached the top, he laid her body down. At the second pyre, a silent brother was doing the same with Robert Lightwood's corpse. Diana had also gone to stand beside Ty. There was a white flower tucked into her collar, pale against her dark skin. She said something quietly to him, and Ty looked up at her. Julian ached inside, a physical ache, as if he'd been punched in the stomach and was now just getting his breath back. He could feel the bloody cloth tied around his wrist, like a circle of fire. Emma. He looked for her in the crowd, saw her standing beside Simon. Christina had come to stand with them. The ladders had been drawn away, and the silent brothers stepped forward with their lit torches. Their fire was bright enough to illuminate even the daylight scene. Emma's hair sparked and caught its brilliance as the silent brothers took their places around the pyres. These flames, this burning, said Mark, who had appeared at Julian's side. In the wild hunt we practiced sky burial. Julian glanced at him. Mark was flushed, his pale curls disordered. His mourning runes had been applied with care and precision, though, which meant he hadn't done them himself. They were beautiful and delicately done, Christina's work. We would leave bodies at the tops of glaciers or high trees for the birds to pick clean, Mark said. How about you not suggest that to anyone else at this funeral, said Julian. Mark winced. I'm sorry, I don't always know the right thing to say. When in doubt, don't say anything, Julian said. Literally, it's better if you don't talk at all. Mark gave him the same look Helen had before, half hurt and half surprise. But before he could say anything, Gia Penhallow, in ceremonial robes of dazzling snow white, began to speak.
Fellow shadow hunters, she said, her rich voice carrying across the imperishable fields. A great tragedy has come to us. One of our most faithful servants of the Clave, Robert Lightwood, was slain in the council hall, where our law has always prevailed.
Good job not mentioning he was a traitor, muttered someone in the crowd. It was Zara. A hissing spurt of giggles erupted around her, like a teapot exploding. Her friends, Manuel Villalobos, Samantha Larkspear, and Jessica Beausejour stood around her in a tight circle.
I can't believe they're here.
It was Emma. Somehow she had come up beside Julian. He didn't remember it happening, but reality seemed to be flickering in and out like a camera shutter opening and closing. She looked slightly taken aback when Julian didn't reply, but she stalked off into the crowd, stiff-arming Gladstone out of the way.
Also, one of our youngest and most promising and innocent shadow hunters was murdered. Her blood spilled in front of us all, said Gia, as Emma reached Zara and her friends. Zara jumped back slightly, and tried to hide her loss of poise with a glare. Emma wouldn't care one way or another, Julian thought, about Zara's poise. She was gesturing at Zara, and then at the Blackthorns and Ty, as Gia's voice rang out over the meadow.
We will not let those deaths go unpunished.
We will not forget those who were responsible. We are warriors, and we will fight, and fight back.
Zara and her friends were looking mulish. All but Manuel, who was smiling a sideways smile that, under other circumstances, would have given Julian the creeps. Emma turned and walked away from them. Her expression was grim. Still, Zara had stopped talking, which was something.
"They are gone," said Gia. "The Nephilim have lost two great souls. Let Raziel bless them. Let Jonathan Shadowhunter honor them. Let David the Silent remember them. And let us commend their bodies to the necropolis, where they will serve forever."
The consul's voice had softened. Everyone was looking toward her, even the children, like Tabby, Rafe, and Max. So everyone saw her expression change and darken. She spoke the next words as if they tasted bitter in her mouth.
"And now, our new Inquisitor wants to say a few words."
Horace Dearborn stepped forward. Julian hadn't noticed him until that moment. He wore a white mourning robe and a suitably grave expression, though there seemed to be a sneer behind it, like a shadow behind glass. Zara was grinning openly, and more of her friends from the Scholomance had gathered near her. She gave her father a little wave, still grinning, and Manuel's smirk spread until it covered most of his face. Julian saw the nausea in Isabel's and Simon's expressions, the horror on Emma's face, the anger on Magnus's and Alex. He strained to feel what they felt, but he couldn't. He felt nothing at all. Horace Dearborn took a long moment to survey the crowd. Kit had gleaned enough from the others to know that Zara's father was an even worse bigot than she was, and that he'd been named the new Inquisitor by a majority of the council, all of whom seemed more scared of the Unseelie Court and the threat of downworlders than they were of investing a clearly evil man with power. Not that Kit found any of this surprising, just depressing. Ty, beside him, didn't seem to be looking at Horace at all. He was staring up at Livy, or the little of her they could see. She was a scrap of white on top of a tall pile of kindling wood. As he looked at his sister, he drew his right index finger across the back of his left hand over and over. Otherwise he was motionless.
"Today," Horace said finally, "as the consul says, may indeed be a day for grief."
"Nice of him to acknowledge," murmured Diana.
"However," Horace's voice rose and he stabbed a finger out into the crowd, as if accusing them all of a terrible crime. "These deaths did not come from nowhere. There is no question who is responsible for these murders. Though foolish shadow hunters may have allowed them to occur, the hand of the Unseelie King and all fairies and all downworlders by connection were behind this act."
Why would that be? Kit thought. Horace reminded him of politicians shouting on TV. Red-faced men, who always seemed angry and always wanted you to know there was something you needed to be afraid of. The idea that if the Unseelie King was responsible for Livy's and Robert's deaths, all downworlders were guilty, made no sense to Kit. But if he was hoping for a protest from the crowd, he was disappointed. The gathering was strangely quiet, but Kit didn't get the sense that they were against Horace. Rather, they seemed as if they felt it would be impolite to cheer. Magnus looked on with no expression at all, as if it had been wiped from his face with an eraser.
"Death serves as a reminder," said Horace, and Kit glanced over at Julian, whose dark brown hair was blowing in the rising wind. Kit doubted this was a reminder Julian needed. "A reminder that we have only one life, and we must live it as warriors," A reminder that we have only one chance to make the correct choices. A reminder that the time is coming soon when all shadow hunters will have to decide where they stand. Do they stand with traitors and downworlder lovers? Do they stand with those who would destroy our way of life and our very culture? Do they... Young man, what are you doing? Get down from there.
Oh, by the angel, Diana whispered. Ty was climbing up the side of his sister's pyre. It didn't look easy. The wood had been piled up for maximum efficiency burning, not for clambering. But he was finding handholds and footholds anyway. He was already high enough off the ground that Kit felt a bolt of fear go through him at the thought of what would happen if one of the logs of wood came free and he fell. Kit started after him without thinking, only to feel a hand close on his collar. He was jerked back by Diana. No, she said. Not you. Her face was set in grim lines. Not you. Kit saw what she meant in the moment. Julian Blackthorne was already running, shoving past the Inquisitor, who squawked indignantly, and leaping for the pyre. He began to climb after his brother. Julian? Emma called. But she doubted he could hear her. Everyone was shouting now. The council guards, the mourners, the consul, and Inquisitor. Zara and her friends were hooting with laughter, pointing at Ty. He had nearly reached the top of the pyre, but didn't seem to hear anyone or anything around him. He was climbing with a dogged intensity. Julian, below him, climbing more carefully, couldn't match his speed. Only the Blackthorns were utterly silent. Emma tried to push forward, but Christina held on to her wrist, shaking her head. Don't! It's not safe. Better not to distract Julian. Ty had reached the platform atop the pyre. He sat down there, perched beside his sister's body. Helen gave a little whimper in her throat. Ty! There was no protection from the wind at the top of the pyre. Ty's hair whipped around his face as he bent over Livy. It looked as if he were touching her folded hands. Emma felt a wave of empathic sorrow like a punch to the gut, followed by another wave of anxiety. Julian reached the platform beside Ty and Livy. He knelt beside his brother. They looked like two pale chess pieces, only the color of their hair, Ty's a little darker, differentiating them in color. Emma felt her heartbeat in her throat. It was one of the hardest things she'd ever done, not to run to the pyre and climb it. Everything else but Julian and Ty seemed distant and far off. Even when she heard Zara and her friends giggle that the Silent Brothers should light the pyre, should burn Ty and Julian, along with Livy, if they wanted to be with her so badly. She felt Christina stiffen beside her. Mark was walking across the grass toward the two pyres. Zara and her friends were muttering about him now, about his pointed ears, his fairy blood. Mark walked with his head down, determined, and Emma couldn't stand it anymore. She broke away from Christina and ran across the grass. If Mark was going to go after Julian and Ty, then she was too. She caught a glimpse of Gia beside Maris and Jocelyn, all of them motionless. A horrified tableau. Shadow hunters didn't do this sort of thing. They didn't make a spectacle of their grief. They didn't scream or rage or collapse or break down or climb to the tops of pyres. Julian had bent and taken his brother's face in his hands. It made for a peculiarly tender portrait, despite their location. Emma could imagine how difficult this was for him. He hated showing emotion in front of anyone he couldn't trust. But he didn't seem to be thinking about that. He was murmuring to Ty, their foreheads almost touching.
The ladders,
Emma said to Mark, and he nodded without asking anything further. They pushed past a knot of onlookers and grabbed one of the heavy ladders the Silent Brothers had carried to the field, propping it against the side of Livy's pyre.
Julian,
Emma called, and she saw him glance down at her as she and Mark held the ladder steady. Somewhere, Horace was shouting at them to leave it alone and for the council guards to come and drag the boys down. But nobody moved.
Julian touched Ty once on the cheek, and Ty hesitated, his arms coming up to hug himself briefly. He dropped them and followed Julian as they climbed down the ladder, Julian first. When he hit the ground, he didn't move, just looked up, poised to catch his brother if he fell. Ty reached the ground and walked away from the pyre without stopping to catch his breath, heading across the grass toward Kit and Diana.
Someone was shouting at them to move the ladder. Mark hoisted it and carried it over to the Silent Brothers, while Emma took hold of Julian's wrists and drew him gently away from the side of the pyres. He looked stunned, as if he'd been hit with enough force to make him dizzy. She stopped some distance from any other people and took both his hands in hers. No one would think anything odd of it. That was a normal sort of affection between Parabatai. Still, she shivered at the combination of touching him and the horror of the situation and the blank look on his face. "Julian," she said, and he winced.
"My hands," he said, sounding surprised. "I didn't feel it."
She glanced down and sucked in her breath. His palms were a crazy quilt of bloody splinters from the kindling wood. Some were small dark lines against his skin, but others were bigger, snapped off toothpicks of wood that had gone in at an angle, oozing blood. "You need an Arazi," she said, letting go of one of his wrists and reaching to her belt for a steely. "Let me—" "No." He drew his other wrist free of her hold. His expression was colder than glacial ice. "I don't think that would be a very good idea." He walked away as Emma struggled to breathe. Ty and Mark had returned to where the Blackthorns were standing. Ty was near Kit, as he almost always was, like a magnet clicking into place. She saw Mark reach out to take Christina's hand and hold it and thought, "I should be holding Julian's hands. I should be there for him, reminding him there are still things in the world worth living for." But Julian's hands were bloody and wounded, and he didn't want her to touch them, as his soul was torn and bloody, and maybe he didn't want anyone near that either. But she was different. She was his Parabatai, wasn't she?
"It is time." The silent voice of one of the brothers rippled across the fields. They all heard it, except Magnus and Max, who looked around in confusion.
Emma barely had time to brace herself before the silent brothers touched their torches to the kindling wood at the foot of each pyre. Fire blasted upward, rippling in shades of gold and red, and for a moment it was almost beautiful.
Then the roar of the flames hit her, like the sound of a crashing wave, and the heat rolled across the grass.
And Livy's body vanished behind a sheet of smoke.
Kit could barely hear the soft chant of the Nephilim over the greedy crackle of the flames.
"Wale, wale, wale. Farewell. Farewell, farewell."
The smoke was thick. His eyes stung and burned, and he couldn't stop thinking of the fact that his own father had had no funeral, that there had been little of him left to bury, his flesh turned to ash by manted venom, his remains disposed of by the Silent Brothers. Kit couldn't bear to look at the Blackthorns, so he stared at the Lightwoods. He had overheard all their names by now. He knew Alec's sister was Isabel, the girl with the black hair who stood with her arms around Alec, and her mother, Maris. Rafe and Max held each other's hands. Simon and Magnus stood close to the others, like small moons of comfort orbiting a planet of grief. He remembered someone saying that funerals were for the living, not the dead, so that they could say goodbye. He wondered about the burning. Was it so that the Nephilim could bid farewell in fire that reminded them of angels? He saw a man come toward the Lightwoods. and blinked his watering eyes. He was a young man, handsome, with curling brown hair and a square jaw. He wasn't wearing white like the others, but plain black gear. As he passed Maris, he stopped and laid a hand on her shoulder. She didn't turn or seem to notice. Neither did anyone else. Magnus glanced over quickly, frowning, but looked away again. Kit realized with a coldness in his chest that he was the only one who could actually see the young man, and that the smoke seemed to flow through the stranger as if he were made of air. A ghost, he thought, like Jessamine. He looked around wildly. Surely there would be more ghosts here in the imperishable fields, their dead feet leaving no traces on the grass. But he saw only the blackthorns clinging together, Emma and Christina side by side, and Julian with Tavi, as the smoke rose up and around them. Half reluctantly, he glanced back. The young man with the dark hair had moved to kneel beside Robert Lightwood's pyre. He was closer to the flames than any human could have gotten, and they seemed to eddy within the outline of his body, lighting eyes with fiery tears. Parabatai, Kit thought suddenly. In the slump of the young man's shoulders, in his outstretched hands, in the longing stamped on his face, he saw Emma and Julian. He saw Alec as he spoke about Jace. He knew he was looking at the ghost of Robert Lightwood's Parabatai. He didn't know how he knew it, but he did. A cruel sort of bond, he thought, that made one person out of two people and left such devastation when half was gone. He glanced away from the ghost, realizing that smoke and fire had made a wall now, and the pyres were no longer visible. Livy had disappeared behind the boiling darkness. The last thing he saw before tears blinded him was Ty beside him, lifting his face and closing his eyes, a dark silhouette outlined by the brilliance of the fire, as if he was haloed in gold.
Chapter 4. Nothing That Is Ours. The pyres were still burning as the procession turned and headed back toward the city. It was customary for the smoke to rise all night and for families to gather in Angel Square to mourn, among others. Not that Emma thought it was likely the Blackthorns would do that. They would remain in their house, sequestered with each other. They had been too much apart all their lives to want comfort from other shadow hunters who they barely knew. She had trailed away from the rest of the group, too raw to want to try to talk to Julian again in front of his family. Besides, he was holding Tavi's hand.
Emma? Said a voice beside her.
She turned and saw Jem Carstairs.
Jem. She was too surprised to speak.
Jem had been a silent brother once, and though he was a Carstairs, he was a very distant relative, due to being more than a century old. He looked only about 25, though, and was dressed in jeans and scuffed shoes. He wore a white sweater, which she guessed was his concession to Shadowhunter funeral whites. Jem was no longer a Shadowhunter, though he had been one for many years.
Jem, she whispered, not wanting to disturb anyone else in the procession. Thanks for coming.
I wished you to know how sorry I am, he said. He looked pale and drawn. I know you loved Livia like a sister.
I had to watch her die, said Emma. Have you ever watched someone you love die?
Yes, said Jem. This was the thing about nearly immortal people, Emma thought. It was rare that you had a life experience that they hadn't.
Can we talk? She said abruptly. Just us?
Yes. I wish to speak alone with you myself. He indicated a low rise some distance away, partially hidden by a stand of trees. After whispering to Christina that she was going to talk to Jem.
The Jem? The really old one? Who's married to a warlock, really?
She followed Jem to where he was sitting on the grass, among a tumble of old stones. They sat for a moment in silence, both of them looking out over the imperishable fields.
When you were a silent brother, Emma said abruptly, did you burn people?
Jem looked over at her. His eyes were very dark.
I helped fight the pious, he said. A clever man I knew once said that we cannot understand life, and therefore we cannot hope to understand death. I have lost many I love to death, and it does not get easier, nor does watching the pyres burn.
We are dust and shadows, Emma said. I guess we're all ashes, too.
It was meant to make us all equal, said Jem. We are all burned. Our ashes all go to build the city of bones.
Except for criminals, said Emma. Jem's brow furrowed.
Livia was hardly that, he said. Nor you, unless you are thinking of committing a crime.
I already have. I'm criminally in love with my parabatai.
The desire to say the words, to confess to someone, to Jem specifically, was like a pressure behind Emma's eyes. To forestall them, she said hastily.
Did your parabatai ever pull away from you? When you, you know, wanted to talk?
People do strange things when they're grieving, said Jem gently.
I was watching from a distance earlier. I saw Julian climb to the top of the pyre for his brother. I know how much he has always loved those children. Nothing he says or does now in these first and worst days is symbolic of who he is. Besides, he added with a slight smile, being parabatai is complicated. I hit my parabatai in the face once.
You did what?
As I said, Jem seemed to enjoy her astonishment. I struck my parabatai. I loved him more than anyone else in the world I've ever loved save Tessa. And I struck him in the face, because my heart was breaking. I can hardly judge anyone else.
Tessa, Emma exclaimed. Where is she?
Jem's hand made a fist in the grass.
You know of the warlock illness?
Emma recalled hearing of Magnus's weakness, the swiftness with which his magic was depleted. That it wasn't just him, it was other warlocks too.
Is Tessa sick? She said.
No, Jem said. She was ill, but recovered.
Then the warlocks can get better?
Tessa is the only one who has conquered the sickness. She believes she is protected by her shadow hunter blood. But more and more warlocks are falling ill now. And those who are older, who have used more magic and more powerful magic, are sickening first.
Like Magnus, Emma whispered. How much does Tessa know about it? What have they figured out?
Tessa thinks it might be connected to the spells Malcolm Fade used to raise Annabelle, said Jem. He used the ley lines to power his necromantic magic. If they're poisoned with that darkness, it might be communicating that poison to any warlock who uses them.
Can't warlocks just not use them?
There are only a few sources of power, said Jem. Ley lines are the easiest. Many of the warlocks have stopped using them, but it means they're exhausting their powers very quickly, which is also unhealthy. He gave her an unconvincing smile.
Tessa will solve it, he said.
She found Kit. She'll discover the answer to this as well. Jem bent his head. He kept his hair short, and Emma could see the marks of his silent brother's scars, where the runes of silence had once been placed along his cheek.
I wanted to talk to you about Kit, actually, he said. It's partly why I came.
Really?
Because of Kit?
He's all right, as far as I know.
Sad, like the rest of us.
Kit is more than just a Herondale, he said. The Herondales are important to me, but so are the Carstairs and the Blackthorns. But
Tessa and I knew Kit was in danger from the first time we found out what his heritage was. We rushed to find him, but Johnny Rook had hidden him well.
His heritage? Johnny Rook was a con man, and Kit says his mother was a showgirl in Vegas.
Johnny was a con man, but he also had some Shadowhunter blood in his family. From a long time back, probably hundreds of years. That's not what's significant about Kit, though. What's significant is what he inherited from his mother. He hesitated. Kit's mother's family has been hunted by fairies for many generations. The Unseelie King has been bent on their destruction, and Kit is the last of their line.
Emma fell sideways onto the grass.
Not more fairies, she groaned.
Jem smiled, but his eyes were troubled.
Kit's mother was murdered by a rider, he said.
Foul.
I believe you knew him.
I believe I killed him, said Emma.
She pushed herself back up to sit beside Jem. And now I'm glad.
He murdered Kit's mom? That's awful.
I cannot tell you as much as I wish I could, said Jem. Not quite yet. But I can tell you that there is fairy blood in Kit's family. Kit's mother was hunted, and so was her father, on through the generations. Kit is alive because his mother went to great lengths to conceal the fact that he was born. She covered every link between them, and when she died, the king thought the line died with her.
And that's changed, said Emma.
We fear it might have, said Jem. Tessa and I left Kit with you at the Institute because the warlock sickness was already beginning. We did not know then whether it was something that could spread to humans. We also needed to be in the spiral labyrinth, and they would not let us bring Kit. We always intended to return for him. We had no idea the riders would be dispatched to find you. We cannot know whether or not they recognized him. He looks a great deal like his mother.
I don't think so, said Emma.
Kit looked just like Jace, in her opinion.
So are you going to take Kit with you now? Said Emma. We don't want to lose him, but if you have to.
The warlock sickness has only worsened. Tessa and I are working day and night in the spiral labyrinth to find a cure. And there is something else, he hesitated. Tessa is pregnant.
Oh, congratulations.
It was the first good news Emma had gotten in what felt like forever.
Jem smiled the sort of smile that made it look as if a light had turned on inside him. He had been alone so long, Emma knew, imagining he would never have a family. To have a wife now and a baby on the way. The very ordinary sort of miracles that made up an ordinary life. Must be extraordinary for him.
It is wonderful, he said. He laid a hand on hers.
I trust you, Emma. I wish only to ask you to look out for Kit. And if you see something suspicious, if you see any signs of a search, please tell me. I will come at once.
Should I send a fire message? Emma said, her happiness over the baby fading.
Sometimes it is not possible to send a fire message. There are easier ways. He pressed something into her hand, a simple silver ring with a clear stone set into it.
It's glass, he said.
Smash the ring, and Tessa will know. She has the matching one.
Emma slid the ring onto her finger. She thought of Kit standing faithfully beside Ty at the funeral. She thought of his pale curls and blue eyes and gamine face. Should she have guessed he had fairy blood somewhere?
No. He didn't look like Mark. He looked like a Herondale, like Jace, like that was all he was.
You can trust me, she said. I'll look out for Kit. Is there anything I can do about the ley lines?
It would be useful to have a shadow hunter in Los Angeles checking out the locus point of Malcolm's magic, said Jim. When you get home, contact Katerina Loss. She may want your help.
I will, Emma said. It's good for me to have a purpose, I think.
Libby's dead. Jason Clary are on a mission and can't be reached. And Horace Dearborn is the Inquisitor. It's like there's no hope for anything now.
There is always hope, said Jim.
When I was very young, it was still permitted to take spoils. The property of Downworlders could be confiscated by any Shadowhunter. I knew a man who kept the heads of slaughtered fairies in the institute he ran. Emma made a nauseated noise. There has ever been this strain of poison running through the dark heart of the Clave. But there are many more who know Downworlders are our brothers. We are all children under the Angel, he sighed. And though I cannot remain with you, simply smash this ring and I will come, no matter how distant I may be. He put an arm around her and hugged her close for a moment. Take care, Mamie.
What does that mean?
Emma asked. But he was already gone, vanishing into the trees as swiftly as he'd come. Kit stood and watched the smoke rising in the distance through the window of the room he shared with Ty. At least he assumed he was sharing the room with Ty. His bag was here, tossed into a corner, and nobody had ever bothered to tell him whether he was supposed to be in a different room. He'd gotten dressed in the bathroom that morning and emerged to find Ty pulling his T-shirt on over his head. His marks seemed unusually black, probably because his skin was so pale. He looked so delicate. Kit had to glance away from the shape of his shoulder blades, the fragility of his spine. How could he look like that and be strong enough to fight demons? Now Ty was downstairs with the rest of his family. People tended to cook when someone died, and shadow hunters were no exception. Someone was probably making a casserole, a demon casserole. Kit leaned his head against the cold glass of the window. There was a time he could have run, Kit thought. He could have run and left the shadow hunters behind, lost himself in the underground world of shadow markets, been like his father, not part of any world, existing between them. In the reflection of the window glass, Kit saw the bedroom door open and Ty come in. He was still wearing his morning clothes, though he'd taken off the jacket and was just in a long-sleeve T-shirt. And Kit knew it was too late to run, that he cared about these people now, and specifically Ty.
I'm glad you're here.
Ty sat down on the bed and started unlacing his boots. I wanted to talk to you. The door was slightly open, and Kit could hear voices coming from the kitchen downstairs. Helen's, Drew's, Emma's, Julian's. Diana had gone back to her own house. Apparently she lived in a weapons store or something like that. She'd gone back to get some kind of tool she thought could fish the splinters out of Julian's bleeding hands. Ty's hands were fine, but he'd been wearing gloves. Kit had seen Julian's when he'd gone to rinse them out of the sink, and they looked like shrapnel had blown into his palms. Emma had stood nearby looking worried, but Julian had said he didn't want neurotsy, that it would just heal the skin closed over the bits of wood. His voice had sounded flat. Kit had barely recognized it.
I know how this is going to sound, Kit said, turning so his back was against the cold glass.
Ty was hunched over, and Kit caught the gleam of gold at his neck.
But you're not acting the way I expected.
Ty kicked his boots off.
Because I climbed up the pyre?
No, that was kind of actually the most expected thing you did, said Kit. I did it to get this, Ty said, and put his hand to his throat. Kit recognized the gold chain and the slim disc of metal attached to it. Livy's locket, the one he'd helped her with in London. It had a circlet of the family thorns on the front,
and she had told him Julian had added an etching to the back, a pair of crossed sabers, Livy's weapon. Kit vividly remembered her holding her hair aside as he fastened the clasp, and the smell of her perfume. His stomach lurched with sadness.
"Livy's necklace," he said. "I mean, I guess it makes sense. I just thought you would..."
"Cry?" Ty didn't look angry, but the intensity in his gray eyes had deepened. He was still holding the pendant. "Everybody is supposed to be sad, but that's because they accept Livy is dead. But I don't. I don't accept it."
"What?"
"I'm going to get her back," said Ty. Kit sat down heavily on the windowsill.
"How are you going to do that?"
Ty let go of the necklace and took his phone out of his pocket. "These were on Julian's phone," he said. "He took them when he was in the library with Annabelle. They're photos of the pages of the Black Volume of the Dead."
"When did you get these?"
Kit knew texting didn't work in Idris.
"Does Julian know you have them?"
"I set up his phone so it would back up to mine. I guess he didn't realize. Then, when I saw these in London, I..." Ty gave Kit a worried frown. "You won't tell him, will you?"
"Of course not."
"Will you come and sit down next to me so you can see them?" Kit wanted to say no. He couldn't say it. He wanted this not to be happening, but it was. When he sat down next to Ty on the bed, the mattress sagged, and he knocked against Ty's elbow accidentally. Ty's skin felt hot against his, even through his t-shirt, as if the other boy had a fever. It had never crossed his mind that Ty was lying or wrong, and he didn't seem to be either. After 15 years with Joni Rook, Kit was pretty familiar with what bad spell books were like, and this one looked decidedly evil. Spells in cramped handwriting littered the pages, along with creepy sketches of corpses crawling out of the grave, screaming faces, and charred skeletons. Ty wasn't looking at the photographs like they were creepy, though. He was looking at them like they were the Holy Grail. "This is the most powerful spellbook for bringing back the dead that's ever existed," he said. "That's why it didn't matter if they burned Livy's body. With spells like these, she can be brought back whole, no matter what happened to her, no matter how long..." He broke off with a shuddering breath. "But I don't want to wait. I want to start as soon as we get back to Los Angeles."
"Didn't Malcolm kill a lot of people to bring Annabelle back?" said Kit.
"Correlation, not causation, Watson," said Ty. "The simplest way to do necromancy is with death energy. Life for death, basically. But there are other sources of energy. I would never kill anyone." He made a face that was probably supposed to be scornful, but was actually just cute.
"I don't think Livy would want you to do necromancy," Kit said.
Ty put his phone away.
"I don't think Livy would want to be dead."
Kit felt the words like a punch to the chest, but before he could reply, there was a commotion downstairs. He and Ty ran to the top of the stairwell, Ty in his stocking feet, and looked down into the kitchen. Zara Dearborn's Spanish friend Manuel was there, wearing the uniform of a guard officer and a smirk. Kit leaned forward more to see who he was talking to. He caught sight of Julian leaning against the kitchen table, his face expressionless. The others were ranged around the kitchen. Emma looked furious, and Christina had her hand on the other girl's arm, as if to hold her back.
"Really?" Helen said furiously. "You couldn't wait until the day after our sister's funeral to drag Emma and Jules to the guard?"
Manuel shrugged, clearly indifferent. "It has to be now," he said.
"The consul insists." "What's going on?" Aline said. "You're talking about my mother, Manuel. She wouldn't just demand to see them without a good reason."
"It's about the mortal sword," Manuel said. "Is that a good enough reason for all of you?"
Ty tugged at Kit's arm, pulling him away from the stairs.
They moved down the upstairs hallway, the voices in the kitchen receding but still urgent.
Do you think they'll go? Kit said.
Emma and Jules?
They have to. The consul's asking, said Ty. But it's her, not the Inquisitor, so it'll be all right.
He leaned in toward Kit, whose back was against the wall.
He smelled like a campfire.
I can do this without you. Bring Livy back, I mean, he said. But I don't want to. Sherlock doesn't do things without Watson.
Did you tell anyone else?
No. Ty had pulled the sleeves of his shirt down over his hands and was worrying at the fabric with his fingers. I know it has to be a secret. People wouldn't like it, but when Livy comes back, they'll be happy, and they won't care.
Better to ask forgiveness than permission, Kit said, feeling dazed.
Yes. Ty wasn't looking directly at Kit. He never did. But his eyes lit up hopefully. In the dim light of the hallway, the gray in them was so pale it looked like tears.
Kit thought of Ty sleeping, how he slept the whole day of Livy's death and into the night, and the way Kit had watched him sleep in terror of what would happen when he awoke. Everyone had been terrified. Ty would fall apart, they'd thought. Kit remembered Julian standing over Ty as he slept, one hand stroking his brother's hair, and he'd been praying. Kit didn't even know Shadowhunters prayed, but Julian definitely had been. Ty would crumble in a world without his sister, they'd all thought. He'd fall away to ashes, just like Livy's body. And now, he was asking Kit for this, saying he didn't want to do it without him. And what if Kit said no, and Ty crumbled from the pressure of trying to do it alone? What if Kit took away his last hope and he fell apart because of it? You need me, Kit said slowly.
Yes.
Then, Kit said, knowing already that he was making a huge mistake, I'll help you.
It was cold in the Scholomance, even during the summer. The school had been carved into a mountainside, with long windows running all along the cliff face. They provided light, as did the witch light chandeliers in nearly every room, but no warmth. The chill of the lake below, deep and black in the moonlight, seemed to have seeped into the stone of the walls and floor and to radiate outward, which was why, even in early September, Diego Rocio Rosales was wearing a thick sweater and coat over his jeans. Dusty witchlight sconces cast his shadow, long and thin, in front of him as he hurried down the hallway toward the library.
In his opinion, the Scholomance was direly in need of an update. The one time his brother Jaime had ever visited the school, he said it looked as if it had been decorated by Dracula. This was unfortunately true. Everywhere there were iron chandeliers, which made Kieran sneeze. Bronze, dragon-shaped sconces holding ancient witchlight stones, and cavernous stone fireplaces with huge, carved angels standing forbiddingly on either side. Communal meals were taken at a long table that could have accommodated the population of Belgium, though at the moment there were less than 20 people in residence at the school. Most of the teachers and students were either at home or in Idris, which made it much easier for Diego to hide a fairy prince on the premises. He'd been nervous about the idea of concealing Kieran at the Scholomance. He wasn't a good liar at the best of times, and the effort of maintaining a relationship with Zara had worn him down already. But Christina had asked him to hide Kieran, and he would have done anything for Christina. He'd reached the end of the corridor where the door to the library was. Long ago, the word Bibliotheca had adorned the door in gold lettering. Now only the outlines of the letters remained, and the hinges squeaked like distressed mice when Diego shoved the door open. The first time he'd been shown the library, he thought it was a prank. A massive room, it was on the top floor of the Scholomance, where the roof was made of thick glass and light filtered down through it. During the time that the school had been deserted,
Massive trees had taken root in the dirt beneath the floor. Kieran had commented that they seemed to have the strength of fairy oaks. No one had had the time or money to remove them. They remained, surrounded by the dust of broken stone. Their roots had cracked the floor and snaked among the chairs and shelves. Branches spread out wide above, forming a canopy over the bookshelves, dusting the seats and floors with fallen leaves. Sometimes Diego wondered if Kieran liked it in here because it reminded him of a forest. He certainly spent most of his time in a window seat, somewhat grimly reading everything in the section on fairies. He had made a pile of books he considered accurate. The pile was small. He glanced over as Diego came in. His hair was blue-black, the color of the lake outside the window. He had put two books into his accurate pile and was reading a third, Mating Habits of the Unseelie. I do not know anyone in Faerie who has married a goat, he said irritably, in either the Seelie or the Unseelie court. Don't take it personally, Diego said. He pulled a chair over and sat down facing Kieran. He could see them both reflected in the window. Kieran's bony wrists stuck out below the sleeves of his borrowed uniform. Diego's clothes had all been too big for him, so Rayan Maduabachi had offered to lend Kieran some. He didn't seem bothered that Diego was hiding a fairy in his room, but nothing much ruffled the surface of Rayan's calm. Divya, on the other hand, Diego's other best friend at the school, leapt nervously into the air every time anyone mentioned they were going to the library, despite Kieran's uncanny ability to hide himself. Divya and Rayan were the only people Diego had told about Kieran, mostly because they were the only people currently at the Scholomance that he trusted. There was only one professor in residence, Professor Gladstone, who was currently in Idris for the Inquisitor's funeral. Besides, while there had been a time that Diego would have trusted a professor without a second thought, that time was past. Have you heard anything from Idris? Said Kieran, looking down at his book. You mean Mark, said Diego. And I haven't heard anything from him. I am not his favorite person. Kieran glanced up. Are you anyone's? Somehow he managed to ask it, as if it weren't an insulting question, but something he merely wished to know. Diego, who sometimes wondered the same thing himself, didn't answer. I thought you might have heard from Christina, Kieran closed the book, marking his place with his finger, about whether she was all right, and Mark thought the funerals were today. They were, Diego said. He also thought they might have heard from Christina. He knew she'd been fond of Livia Blackthorn. But funerals for us are very busy times. There's a great deal of ceremony, and a lot of people who visit and express condolences. She might not have much time. Kieran looked pained. That seems as if it would be annoying. In Faerie, we know to leave those who are grieving to themselves. It's annoying, but also not, Diego said. He thought of the death of his grandfather, how the house had been full of velas. Candles that burned with a beautiful light, how visitors had come and brought gifts of food, and they had eaten and drunk together and remembered his abuelo. Everywhere there had been marigolds and the cinnamon smell of atole and the sound of laughter. It seemed cold to him and lonely to grieve by yourself, but fairies were different. Kieran's eyes sharpened as if he'd seen something revealing in Diego's expression. Is there a plan for me? He asked. Where am I to be sent when my time hiding here is over? I had thought you might want to return to Los Angeles, said Diego, surprised. Kieran shook his head. Locks of his hair had turned white. His hair color seemed to change with his mood. No, I will not go back to where Mark is. Diego was silent. He hadn't really had a plan. Christina had asked him to hide Kieran, but had never said for how long. He had wanted to do this for her, because he knew he owed her. He had thought of Zara, had remembered the hurt on Christina's face when she'd first met Zara. It had been his fault. He hadn't told her about Zara because he'd been desperately hoping something would happen that would get him out of the engagement before it was necessary. It was the Dearborns who had insisted on the marriage contract. They had threatened to expose